Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening The Lobster, Song of Lahore, Eddie the Eagle, Peggy Guggenheim, Art Addict, I Saw the Light, Knight of Cups, and more. And at the E-Bar on April 14th, experience the final Shiva Boom with DJ Echo Deck. On April 15th, go dancing at Fierce. And on April 16th, Guelph Poetry Slam welcomes Spencer Butt. The Bookshelf is an independently owned cultural hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph, Ontario. For more information about the Bookshelf's hours, listings, blogs, directions, accessibility, and to order books from their online store from anywhere in the world, please visit the newly designed bookshelf.ca. On Thursday, April 14th, Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet and the Sadies are playing The District in Guelph together at the same place, pretty much at the same time. The Sadies and Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet. Two of the greatest bands of all time. Same place, same time. That's amazing news. District is located above Van Gogh's Ear at 10 Wyndham Street, and the doors for the show open at 8 p.m., This is a rare and great show. Let's all go to it. Everyone, from wherever you're listening, just come to Guelph. Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet and the Sadies at the same time. Come on.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Hello and welcome to episode 248 of the Creative Control Show. I'm your host, Vish. As always, always the host of my own show, somehow. No one has kicked me off my own show. On this episode, Ray Robertson joins me for a long and extensive chat about his new book, Lives of the Poets with Guitars, 13 Outsiders Who Changed Modern Music. Ray Robertson is a noted author and novelist based in Toronto. He's originally from Chatham, Ontario, and he's written 10 acclaimed books, including this new collection that I just mentioned, Lives of the Poets with Guitars, which is out now via Biblioasis. Ray and I caught up in his living room shortly after the book originally came out in Canada on March 15th. It's out now in the United States this week, as you're listening to it, to the show, rather. April 12th, it was scheduled to come out in the States. And it's a great book. It chronicles the lives of Gene Clark of the Byrds, Ronnie Lane of the Small Faces, the Ramones, Sister Rosetta Tharpe,
Towns Van Zandt, Little Richard, Alan Wilson of Canned Heat, Willie P. Bennett, Graham Parsons, Hound Dog Taylor, Paul Siebel, Willis Allen Ramsey, and John Hartford. And they're all profiled in this book with really moving personal essays by Ray. He's a good man, and we'd met once before, so this was only the second time we'd met, and it was a really good conversation about music and obscurity and fans and bands and how they each grapple with the artist's obscurity. I thought it was really interesting. He's a good man. Pick up his book. It's great. Lives of the Poets with Guitars, 13 Outsiders Who Changed Modern Music. Hear it for yourself right now. This is myself and Ray Robertson.
Some people want to go out afterwards, so I'm all perpetually hungover for 4 days.
You're perpetually hungover for 4 days after a book tour?
Well, just because every night there's some event that night, right? People want to go out to do it, so it's like every day starts over. So,
is there a wild and seedy underbelly?
Just seedy,
to literature. Like, you know, we're used to hearing these stories of musicians and debauchery.
Oh, no, not, this is fourth rate, but it's always... It's like, well, you know, the Toronto one is a big one because it's, you know, it's people, it's a big, big deal. And it was, Tuesday was great. But Wednesday and Thursday were Southwestern Ontario, where I kind of know some people. So people want to go out afterward and have some drinks and stuff.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So, and then it was Tuesday, Toronto, Wednesday, Windsor, and Thursday was Chatham. And then Friday was an event just outside of Chatham. So, yeah, it was just good to be home. And
so you have little pockets of friends? And
People I knew from the, like, people literally I don't see until I have a book come out that I knew from way back.
Right.
But we're in different worlds. But they come out and they buy a book and they're like, hey, let's go. So, yeah, it's good. And Windsor's kind of like a second home down there because that's where Biblioasis is.
Yeah, your publisher, yeah.
Yeah, and so kind of, it has probably got more readers in Windsor than I do in Chatham because Chatham's not a real big reading place. So, yeah, it was good. You know, it's just... It's the fate of the writer from Southwestern Ontario. It's equivalent to my publisher and I were talking about this. It's kind of the equivalent of, you know, Eudora Welty or Flannery O'Connor. They wrote about the South in the South, but they were read in New York. They weren't read in the South, right?
Yeah, sure,
you
right.
Know? It's
right.
Just the way it is. You know?
That kind of, that weird objective, like, it's not an exoticization necessarily.
Yeah, but the element of that, yeah.
Maybe there's just like...
How could it be literature if it's about where we're from?
Right,
you know?
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
Not New York or Toronto or Newfoundland with the romance. It's Chatham, you know, with factories in front, which is my work to a great degree, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this book isn't, but yeah, so.
Okay.
Anyway, glad to be home.
Now, where you've been in Toronto, for? Where are you from originally?
Chatham.
You're from Chatham?
Southwest Ontario, yeah.
Oh, so
yeah.
When you say there's not a lot of readers there, it's not a slight, you're just
no.
Like, that's your personal experience.
Yeah, it's my personal experience. I mean, it's just the way it is. And the people that are there, though, that are readers are very, very supportive, though. It's very much a, you know, circle the wagons kind of deal. But it's just not, you know, it's a town that's, it's a working class town and a lot of farmers and but it's a great material and the people that are there are very supportive. Yeah, so I grew up in Chatham, went to high school there, and then went to U of T, and you know, way back, and that's when I moved to Toronto. I guess it would have been 85, and then my wife and I went to graduate school. I met her in 90, and we went to graduate school in Texas for 3 years, and came back in Toronto in 97. That's the year my first book came out, Home Movies, 19 years ago, and this book that we're talking about today, in part, is my 10th book. So yeah, so Toronto for the last 30 years, I guess.
Why Texas?
They gave me money. I was tired of working for a living, so right. It seemed like a way to avoid reality.
Scholarship?
Yeah, well, down the States, too, you can get, they have this thing called freshman composition. Every American university, it was initiated by Harvard back in the early 20th century, where every student, no matter if you study the hardest hard sciences or whatever, you got to take 2 semesters of like how to write an essay, clear logical thinking, etc. So the way they do is they get graduate students to teach it. But what they do is you give you a little stipend to live on. They waive your tuition and that kind of deal.
Right.
Plus the fact that when I was looking around, one of the writers who was teaching there was a friend or was a fan of one of my favorite writers, Thomas McGuane, probably my favorite writer. So it seemed like a good fit. And also it was a beautiful little part of Texas. It was in the Texas Hill Country, so it's right between Austin and San Antonio, a little town called San Marcos.
Right.
So it wasn't like a Dallas or a Houston. It wasn't like a big city kind of deal. And Austin was funky. And my wife went to UT San Antonio for painting, and so... it's a very bilingual town, whatever. It's very, I mean, it's like half Spanish. I mean, the Bud commercials are in English and Spanish, so it was very exotic and really funky place. And Austin, of course, had lots of good stuff, music bookstores and record stores. And so it was a great experience. Yeah. So we came back in 97. My first book was accepted a few days before the beginning of my last year of grad school. So we kind of like, this is pre-internet, so we would do everything through fax and all that, and then came back here in May of 97, not knowing really what we're going to do. And
so you were there about 7 years?
In the States, four.
4 years, sorry. Yeah, okay. Oh, you met your wife in 90, you said.
Yeah, I met my wife in 90, yeah, okay. At a Halloween party, yeah. So.
And have friends commented on it, and any, when you came back, did they notice any discernible change in you? Because I hear when you talk about your American experience, I'll forgive me if this sounds weird. Mm. I hear less of a Southern Ontario accent.
Really?
I hear a little Texas. Really? I hear a little twang.
Well, a little twang. No, I grew up. Now Chatham is an hour from Detroit, right?
Right.
So, like, my wife grew up in Northern Ontario, like north, like 4 hours north of Thunder Bay. Like, she's from the north, like bears in your garbage kind of north, right?
Wow.
Geraldton, Atticoke, and where I grew up was far south as you can go. So my experience, as people know from reading my novels, is not the quintessential Canadian novel experience, which ironically is true of most of Canadians. 80% of the Canadians live within 100 miles of the American border, but you don't see that in a lot of Canadian literature. Anyway,
right.
American television, American radio, a lot of my early formative influences were like listening to CKLW out of Detroit, you know, the Big 800, like all that stuff, you know, CKLW and American TV, whereas, you know, my wife's watching CBC, you know, watching The Beachcombers was a big deal for her.
Right, sure.
So I always had that American. And my primary literary influences were mostly American, like Carson McCullers and McGuane, Kerouac, Barry Hanna, where I think a lot of Canadian writers, it's more of a European thing. Plus, I didn't study English at university, so I never, I studied philosophy. So
even in Texas, that was
no. In Texas, I did creative writing.
Okay,
yeah,
right,
yeah. But
right,
at U of T, I studied philosophy, and that's the reason that I went, because I didn't know any of the writers, and I kind of got the bug. I kind of got the religion right after I met my wife. I'd never written anything. I'd written, you know, some bad poetry, and you know, it was the confluence of meeting her, this practicing artist, she's a painter. Finding the right books. It was boom, 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 discovering those old vintage contemporaries. I discovered, you know, these writers, McGuane and Hannah, and feeling as if when I started writing, like, you know, fumblingly writing, like, this is what I should be doing. You know, it's got storytelling. Who doesn't like stories? Mm-hmm. There was a way for philosophy to be in it, like in the way that the Russian novelists were, who I'd been reading. And of course, I found out that books could be funny and they could be serious. And that was not my experience with a lot of the books that I had been, you know, kind of force-fed, like, literature can be fun and funny, and oh my God, I thought it was supposed to be this serious, you know, it's like a vitamin, you know, it should be good for you kind of deal. So I took to like a duck to water, and but I didn't know any other writers, and I was old. I mean, I felt old. I was, what, you know, 20, 24, 20. She's working upstairs. You know,
oh, is that, okay. Yeah, that was your wife?
Yeah, she's probably throwing a canvas across the room.
Not a happy artist right now?
No, she is. She just was away
What's your wife's name?
Mara Corcolo.
Mara Corcolo, okay.
So I started writing this, and I was like, this is what I should be doing, but I didn't have anyone to talk to it with, because I didn't know any writers or anything. So I would, this is pre-internet, so I'd go down to the Robarts Library at U of T and go through the microfiche and look at these American writing programs, and they all had these scholarships or whatever kind of deal. And so it seemed like, and she graduated from OCA and had a dealer for her work, but she felt really closed in and felt very boxed in, like she had a certain style and she was trying to support herself, and she was like, I'd love to run away too. This would be great. So
okay, so you just hit the road.
I applied to a bunch of schools. Most of them didn't give me money, and this one did, and it was in a great place. So we literally packed up our whatever it was, Chevy Vega, whatever it was, the bunch of stuff, and moved to Texas.
Yeah.
And it was exciting too. It was that age. It was pre 9/11. It wasn't quite as crazy down there as it is now. And
philosophically.
Yeah, politically, yeah. I mean, the nicest people, but scary people, many of them. I mean, some of them were, of course, we were spoiled. We were living near Austin,
Austin is a progressive town. Yeah,
and San Marcos isn't really, but it's still a wonderful little place. But it's funny, even the people who you would disagree with violently would still, come pick you up if your car broke down or, that kind of thing.
Friendly, yeah.
As long as you were white,
Right.
But still,
You had that going for you.
Yeah, I had that going for you, right. Being a white male worked out down there.
Good for you.
Sure.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Well, I didn't have a lot to do with it. My parents had sex. That was about it. It was a great experience. And like I said, I literally wrote most of the book there, and then went to the library there and opened up Writer's Market, because I still didn't know any writers in Canada. And I went to the Writer's Market and said, oh, this place sounds good, this place, and started the process of sending it out and getting rejected. And then thankfully, I went from being an old student to a young writer one day in August of 1996, when the letter came in the mail from Jan Geddes at that time, who owned Cormorant Books, and said, I love your novel, and I want to publish it. So, because I didn't know what we were going to do when we came back, because I didn't have any job skills or anything.
Did you have some, or do you, or did you have, it sounds like you did have some ambivalence about your relationship to Canadian literature and your work as an author here. Is that subsided in any way?
Oh yeah, for sure. I feel thoroughly like a Canadian writer. I just don't feel that sometimes the official Canadian publishing industry is, I think it's less than honest, or I don't think it's less than honest. I think people generally believe the bullshit they believe, but I feel Canadian literature goes a lot deeper than the official sanctioned, Giller approved version of literature,
Right.
I think it's a lot grittier and a lot more interesting. There's a lot of great writers that in this country, and I feel myself thoroughly a Canadian writer. Yeah, absolutely. All my books are, Canadian, but I just feel that there's this sort of whitewashed, sanctified version, sort of politically correct version of literature that I think is, it's second rate, and, it is what it is. And
well, there's like every industry, particularly in the arts, there's a star system.
Yeah.
And so you have some cynicism about that.
Well,
I'm
old enough now, my God, this is my 10th book. I'm old now. I don't get angry about it anymore. But yeah, I mean, the big publishers in our country aren't owned by Canadians. They're branch plants of big foreign-owned companies. And the way that corporations work is you create a brand, right? Create a brand. So it's like, I don't know if the books, most people don't know books are good. So it's, there's a new book by so-and-so, I better go buy it. And I saw her on this program. I saw him on that program. I saw him on the cover of the, they must be a good writer then, which is fine. That's the way the industry works, which is why I've been so fortunate the last several years to work with Biblioasis, who I feel, I know this, of course I would say this, even if I didn't believe it, I would be willingly disingenuous, but it is true. I think they're the best publisher in the country. They're owned by a Canadian by the name of Dan Wells, working out of Windsor, literally built it out of his house, had his house, and now he has like 7 full-time employees. They put out 25 books a year. If you care about that kind of thing, they had 3 books on the Giller long list, 2 books on the short list last year. They won the Governor General's Award for Poetry, if you believe in that kind of stuff.
Getting recognized by the same system that you're still somewhat cynical of.
As they're cynical of, and as everybody's cynical of. Hey, listen, don't get me wrong. If you get nominated for these awards, and I've been nominated for a couple of them, it's great. I love the Kinsley Amos line, when he said, well, what about literary awards? And he said, well, it's hopefully nepotistic and subjective. Unless you get nominated. In that case, it's a wonderful objective evaluation of art then, So yeah, it's great. It's great when writers get recognized. I'm just saying that his vision suits my vision, and I'm just so fortunate that we sort of are paths crossed a few years ago in the sense that he lets me write what I want to write. He likes my sentences. I've never had a publisher who understood even what I was saying when I said that, you know.
Yeah.
Do you like my sentences? No, but your story is an engrossing tale. You know, everybody's got an interesting story. There's a million, you know, today's Toronto Sun's going to have a million fascinating, crazy stories, you know, right. Whacked out stories. But can you write a sentence? Can you write a paragraph? Is your work full of wonderful, graceful transitions and humor and darkness? And you know, you find a writer and she's able to combine the serious with the comic. I mean, that's not easy. That's years of craft, right?
Yeah.
This guy likes to talk about craft. You know, that's not going to get you on somebody's radio program or, you know, a profile. It's got to be a subject matter. And I get that. But I've never been strategic about, oh, this would be a great book, you know, for subject matter. I mean, I've had a few that kind of have touched on subject matter. Like I wrote a book of nonfiction called Why Not 15 Reasons to Live, which has done... probably my most successful book, such as it is, because it deals with my depression I had and blah, blah, blah. And so people bought a lot of people bought the book because the subject matter. That sounds great. My niece went through depression. I'll buy your book for you. And publishers love that, whatever. But,
yeah,
you know, but like this book, Lives of the Poets Guitars, I mean, this is truly, to me, a collaboration. There's no other publisher in Canada who would have published this book. Number one, it's this form that is foreign here, you know, an 8,000 word essay that's not scholarly at all. That is my voice, my novelist voice.
Yeah, totally.
And yet, it's about a bunch of musicians that most people, unless they're hip, know about. So there's two strikes against it, right? It's well-written. It's what people don't know about. So,
yeah.
But he's like, yeah, great idea. Let's do it. You know, I know the tradition you're talking about. Nick Tosh, Nick Kent, all the Nicks. You know, this tradition of music. I guess Nick Hornsby to a degree, but not really serious.
Right.
You know, serious but fun, vibrant, you know, music journalism. Not even journalism. I think of these as stories. Anyway, I don't think of them as essays. I think
well,
of them as 13 stories, you know.
It's interesting in what you're saying about the book industry because, and I'll just be frank with you, I hear a mix of incredulity at how it functions. I hear a mix, a little bit of sour grapes,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, sure, of course. Absolutely.
I hear a little, like, obviously cynicism.
Yep.
And I've been, in your book, in Lives of the Poets with the Guitars, I've been wrestling with the notion of obscurity. And,
yeah,
and how,
that's a subtext of the book, you're right.
Right, and there's the just so people understand this, these are profiles of people, some of whom are well-known.
Yeah, the Ramones, Little Richard.
The Ramones and Little Richard. Possibly Graham Parsons, I think, would be in that realm. But then you have Gene Clark, you have Ronnie Lane, and Sister Rosetta Tharpe. You have Towns Van Zandt. The list goes on. Willie P. Bennett. Like, people that hardcore music people would know. Some of them transcended their little communities.
Yeah.
Most of them didn't.
Right.
And I've been thinking about obscurity and what it does to the fanatic and right. What it does for the artist.
Right.
Because when you're saddled with obscurity as an artist, I think that you either grow to, you become resigned to it and understand and appreciate that you have a small following.
Yeah, that's exactly.
But then as a fanatic, as a fan, as an admirer, I think it also does something weird psychologically to you.
Absolutely.
You become a champion.
It's true.
And this is what I, like, the passion of your writing in this book is that of, it's a little indignant. It's just like,
why don't more people know about Willie P. Bennett?
Right, yeah, but then there's also this there's this recognition that some of these people are self-saboteurs.
Yeah,
some of these people did this to themselves.
Or expect too much. And I think you're absolutely in the mark, too. If you're drawing a relation between, I think I wrote these essays too, and I couldn't help but think of the career of the, you know, the mid-list writer to a degree. They are great teachers, that some of them are, in the sense that I was just overwhelmed writing this essay because I knew a lot about the Ramones and you know, love their music, but how bitter they were about their lack of success. And I thought, man, these guys were loved. I don't mean afterward now when they're played in hockey rinks, but I mean, like, even at the time, like, the respect of their peers. And how come they couldn't be happy? And I thought, oh, yeah, that's a lesson on how just to shut up, acknowledge that this world is what it is, be appreciative of the readers that you have, and try to write good books.
Well, I mean, in the Ramones case, and I want to go through
all
of these guys, but in the Ramones case, that's an excellent example of a band that I don't think we're necessarily aware of their power. Because every time anyone championed the Ramones, they were like, look at this.
Right.
We got recognized for what we did. It wasn't, there seemingly wasn't a self-confidence to just be like, oh, you know, nowadays, if someone touts you, you're like, great, yeah, cool, but I'm cool, you know, yeah, like I can.
Yeah.
But the Ramones, I know that, like, if you did you read Marky Ramone's?
Of course, yeah,
book?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I really liked it. Me actually. Too, yeah. I mean, there's some stuff I don't necessarily buy,
or I don't need to know about Marky, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But there is this, like, he's posing with Bono, and he's posing yeah. with, like, yeah. all these people are championing them, and that was really important to them on some level, and yet they were making such a niche music.
Yeah,
like, and to transcend an audience is one thing, and they did.
Most of them were dead, but yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So it's an interesting relationship with their own stature.
Yeah.
And I think in a few of these cases, like, people are frustrated. The musicians yeah. you profile are either yeah. blissfully unaware, they're just doing luckily, their thing, yeah. and 30 people show up their show, yeah. maybe, and yeah. people like you are like, why can't more yeah. people know about this? Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. And I go through it all the time.
Sure.
When you're championing a niche culture or a niche yeah. artist, you become obsessive about their obscurity.
Yeah, more than them.
Sometimes more yeah. than them. So that's an interesting aspect.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. I'd only thought of it from the musician's point of view, but yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know where I'm going with it other than that's a thing I've noticed. And it seems to, as you say, follow the thread of the writer.
Isn't interesting too, though, you know, getting older, because believe me, a lot of this indignation's burned up. I just try to live my life and
sure.
write your book.
That happens.
I'm too old to get angry anymore. You know, I just, like, I'm very fortunate and appreciative of my place, such as it is, et cetera. But thinking about these people, there is an element too that, yeah, I wish more people knew about it. But if they do, I get kind of resentful.
Exactly.
I get kind of like, they're cool. Because, I mean, you mentioned Graham Parsons, more well-known. I mean, I wrote a book called Moody Foo, which is based on Graham Parsons, 2002. But long before that, I mean, my litmus test, if I was out of, this is why I didn't get laid a lot when I was young, university, but would be, you know, hey, do you know who Graham Parsons is? And if the girl said, oh, yeah, I love the Graham Parsons Project, I'd be like, okay, I'm not having sex with you. You know? No, they probably wouldn't have sex with me either. But the point was, you know, it was real hinterland stuff. You know, it was, and then, you know, it's cool enough. And it doesn't feel as good. It's like, I'm in the know. You know, I'm super cool. I know about these things. So it's funny, you know, you kind of want your heroes to be appreciated, but you also want them to be just for you and your friends, you know?
It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
Because I personally am, I don't, the only cases where I feel resentful of success, I think, and I'll just be honest with you, because I do lots of different things, and sometimes you end up being an early champion of someone,
right?
And then maybe they succeed, like maybe they have a huge level of success, and in the cases where people don't forget their roots,
right,
and the fact that people like me or
right.
whoever
yeah.
were there for them,
right.
In those cases, that's great. But, you know, so often you end up in a case where someone is, like, transcended.
Right.
They've kind of used you up.
Right.
And now they're dealing with a huge other stratosphere of stuff, and they don't have time for you.
Right.
Whereas the people I admire the most, weirdly, and the people that have impacted me the most musically, I can contact. And, I mean, that's sort of selfish.
No,
like, they are accessible. And they're human, and I think that it's...
You know, well, I think you've hit on something more than, I don't know what you're getting at, ego or whatever. I think it's... I've been listening to it last, you know, year. I've been listening to a lot of, well, I say the dead, but really it's Jerry Garcia's guitar
yeah.
and solo stuff. And so since then, I've always, oh, the Grateful Dead, you know, one of those bands kind of... but reading up on it, as I know you are, you're the same as me, reading a lot of music books and stuff and history, you really realize that something was lost. Garcia talks about how when people went to our concerts in the beginning, it was more like a party. It was us and the audience doing something together. And then, you know, the years go by and gray gets added to your hair. And before you know it, you're playing a hockey rink or you're playing a football stadium. And he said, and he was obviously a very unhappy guy at the end. Of course, he had monetary reasons to keep going. But there was this kind of collaboration between audience and artist.
Yeah.
Like for the early dead. And you can really hear it in the music. There's like we've got six new songs we're going to give you guys. This is like new stuff.
Yeah,
and they were like they would give them the freedom, which was very rare. You know, Jerry could write a 15-minute wave of noodling, and they could, okay, that's Jerry's thing. If he decided to play bluegrass music with Old and the White, okay, we'll go see that. These hippies didn't know bluegrass music. We'll go. It's Jerry.
Yeah,
we'll go.
Yeah,
and people got turned on to bluegrass
right.
or whatever. Right?
Right.
There's something very, very nice about that. You know, thankful I'll never have to worry about that because I'm never going beyond, cult status. You know, but you look at these musicians, and there's definitely, and the Ramones were kind of like that in the sense they still signed the autographs and still hated each other and still made sure they put on a good show, you know?
Well, I see it in different forms. Like, I think people, like we were talking about earlier about branding, and it's interesting that you mentioned Jerry Garcia kind of breaking up from the Dead and fans following him, because in my case, or in my experience anyway, you know, if you book Lee Ronaldo from Sonic Youth to play a show or a festival, whereas Sonic Youth, the brand,
right,
would fill Massey Hall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Lee's going to play a small club. Yeah. And there's this weird separate, and it's the same guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not all the guys or all the people.
Absolutely.
People have a weird relationship with music sometimes, and I can't tell if it's really about the music.
It's not. It's like Steve Marriott, you know, when Humble Pie, I'm not a huge Steve Marriott fan, but when Humble Pie broke up, he went to America. In turn, it'd be Steve Marriott, formerly of Small Faces, formerly of Humble Pie. He'd play a club. Steve, if you get Humble Pie back there, even if not the original guys, just one of the guys.
Yeah, we call it that.
We can book you into theaters now. We can do that. It's because people say, hey, man, Humble Pie's playing. Let's go party, you know?
Yeah.
Let's go see the Dead, you know? It's like, well, it's all about getting high and hanging out in front of the Pontiac Silverdome. It's really not. I'm hoping the second set they play Dire Wolf. It's not that kind of fan, right?
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, that's where corporations are happy. It's like brand identification. We're not, you know, you don't have to be a hardcore Marxist to understand that most people are being led by the nose by brands and et cetera. And, you know, and again, the anger is not really there anymore. It's just disappointment, but that's the way life is. Exist within it. I really don't have much patience for the woe is me thing and, you know, kind of, you know, oh, the major labels don't understand me, or, you know, I published a couple books with major publishers and like Doubleday, and, you know, they throw it against the wall. If it gets nominated for award, or if you catch lightning in a bottle, great, they're your friends. If not, they don't return your phone calls.
It's a business.
Yeah, it's a business. You got to understand
that,
right?
I do understand it, but I do think, like, as I say, reading this book, and I don't know if I'm why this happened to me, it's going to be different for everyone reading it, obviously, but it just opened up this cycle, this can of worms about the psychological relationship we have with music.
Right.
And where I was going earlier when I say, like, the only resentment I have is when people forget their roots, is that I ultimately, in my work, want the people I like to do well. That's why I'm investing the time. I'm here for you today, because I want people to know about your book.
Right.
And if you're successful, I'm not going to be like, I was first.
No.
There is that mentality, but that's not how I personally, I think, I hope I'm not that way. There's a tendency to be like, you got to check out this Al Tuck record.
Right,
Al Tuck's the greatest songwriter.
Yeah.
I do this all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Al Tuck's the greatest songwriter that I know. You should, and no one knows him. And he's totally could have belonged. He belongs in your book as a figure. Like he.
Just for one second, I want to keep going, but it's funny because the only other person that said it to me is my publisher. He's a huge fan. I was like, who?
Oh, Tuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My publisher, Dan Wells, said, you got to check this guy. And that's only recently he's told me that. So you're the second person.
So there's this romanticization of, I don't want to call it failure, because none of these people are failures. Yeah. But there is a romanticization of hard life.
Yeah.
And struggle. And
the addiction plays into that too. That's really romantic to many people.
Yeah. You know, I mean, when you're reading about Graham or Towns, who are, I mean, for my cohort of people, those are well-known, obscure musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I read your book and see how they basically killed themselves or, you know, and just through...
Or in the case of Towns, killed his art, too. Like,
yes,
I don't
exactly.
Realize it at all. There's been a couple of reviews saying, oh, Robertson's just romanticized. You read the book. I mean, he was this prolific songwriter, put two albums in the last 18 years of his lives, one of them which wasn't any good.
Yeah.
And it's because he cut him, like all alcoholics do, you eventually isolate yourself from your emotions and everything else. I mean, it killed his art.
Yep. And then you have this weird... Because, I mean, these are personal relationships you develop with the artists.
Oh, and we all do, right?
Yeah.
Like, not just, I mean, hopefully this book isn't written for other writers, or it's for people who have that relationship with music, that person. And you do feel as if, I know some of these people better, not only than other people, because you say they're about characters in books, but sometimes better than myself, because we don't go around. I don't spend as much time myself as I do reading about the Ramones or Graham Parsons. And I feel like I understand... things that you're talking about, that kind of tension between self-destruction and, well, like, the, you know, the the Towns essay, one of the themes in it is, you know, how that stuff can liberate you and can also doom you, right? And that, you don't have to be a musician. That could be a guy who works in a factory, can understand it, you know?
That's why, and then this is why we relate to things. Like, you mentioned that your people really related to your book about depression, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, people want to relate to people. Like, I can't really relate necessarily to the experience of Dee Dee Ramone turning tricks on the street.
No.
At the same time, I understand, or I feel like I have an understanding of that world because of him.
And also, what you can understand is the way that all of those guys separately wouldn't have made up the thing that became this special thing.
The chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can understand, too, or be fixated on the idea that they really, truly were, you know, the definition of outsider art, or you know, that kind of, like, they were idiot savants to a degree. I mean, Joey... Johnny does the downstroke because when he practices guitar, he likes to think it looks cool in the mirror. That's how it starts.
Total vanity total, like...
And inability.
Yes.
We're not trying to be primitive. We're primitive. Which is interesting because when they become more proficient, the music's less interesting as they try to sound primitive, right?
Right. Well, and they also, as you mentioned, people were playing Johnny's guitar parts.
Sure. Oh, exactly.
In the studio, yeah.
So that's just interesting, too. And that's what I'm saying. Like, the book to me isn't just for music heads in the sense that I find the story, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe's story, in the sense that, you know, here she is spreading the word as Jesus would want her to do, and she gets condemned by the religious community for playing for secular people. It's like, wait a minute, you know?
Yeah.
And the way that, you know, she adds that little something, that little sexy something to her songs, is that being disrespectful to the impulse, or is that part of what a soul is too? Your body coming a part of that, you know, passion and all that stuff's, you know, it's about music, but
no, but it's about it's life. I mean, the Little Richard chapter is so sensational.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know what? This seems like a nice time to. I had mentioned to you that we should maybe, for the sake of people who don't know this book, Lives of the Poets with the Guitars, we should actually get into the each of their lives.
Yeah, sounds like fun.
However, before we do that, for the sake of chronology, can you maybe, in an overview fashion, talk about why you wanted to write this book?
Yeah, I mostly write novels, a couple other books of nonfiction. As I say in the introduction to the book, I remember realizing a few years ago that music is a part of my novels, like Jim Harrison, nature is to his novels. And I thought, well, okay, it's a pretty big part of it. And I kind of wanted to drop the fictional veil and just say, hey, these are people I care about, and you should care about them too. And if you don't care about their music, their lives are fascinating that way. And I just felt like, and also, you know what, less ethereal answer. As I've gotten older, I need to sort of alternate fiction and nonfiction. I just find that I like to work, and I don't like to be too far away from writing, or I get into trouble a little bit. So I found that the last several years, I write a novel, I write a book of nonfiction, a novel, and it kind of allows part of the brain to relax. I mean, it's still about good sentences and humor and intelligence, but you're not making up a world. I mean, I've got Little Richard's world. Okay, I'll try bringing the page, as opposed to, you know, like a novel like David, which is set in the late 1900s in Southwest Ontario. You got to start from scratch. It's just, you're creating a world, right?
Do you do much journalistic writing?
I used to write book reviews.
Book reviews, right.
But I found that the nonfiction, I can turn it into a book now. So instead of reviewing a book about depression, I write a book about depression, or writing a music review.
From your own personal experience.
Yeah. And so it kind of is that element to it.
I mean, just to be clear, the structure of these essays is very personal.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not, they're journalistic accounts. They include song and record reviews, you know, subjective things.
Yes.
Subjective opinions of their trajectories. It's not simply.
And that's why in the introduction, when it pains, it has to stop some reviewers for saying, though, you know, there are only certain people, this is only this kind of music, or there's only this number of people of this kind of type or whatever. And I was like, you know, write your own book. You know, this is me just, I'm just talking about my record collection. Now, hopefully it transcends that and becomes about, if you read the Sister Rosetta Tharpe essay, it's not really, if you don't give a shit about gospel, well, you do care about the fact that this woman made her art in the face of all this great opposition, and how she handled success, and how she dealt with physical disability. And it's just like, You know, that's the universality. But no, I if I set out, I would go, okay, I need certain people from this genre, that kind of thing. It's like somebody said, well, you know, where are the people, the artists of today? I was like, well, I'm an old man. I don't know who the artists of today. I don't know, man. I'm not going to write about Lady Gaga. Someone else is going to do that. You know what? Maybe some woman will read my book, some kid, and she'll say, you know what? Great book, but grandpa doesn't know about these people. I'm going to write my own book. And that'd be great. I'd be thrilled with that. You know, but I'm not trying to be exhaustive or scholarly or anything. I wouldn't know
you
how to, you know.
You clearly pick subjects that you relate to and whose stories were interesting to you.
And I think the universality is not in selecting X number of women or X number of colors of skin. It's like the universality is that, you know, I can identify with like Little Richard. Okay, it was being gay in a small town. I wasn't gay, but his struggles growing up in a small town that really didn't want him to do anything, like to be flamboyant, to be himself. It's like, you know, get back in line. You know, I can identify with that. Although I wasn't born poor and black and gay in Georgia in 1925, but you know, and I hopefully that's where the universality comes in. You know, you don't blame, you know, anyway, whatever. Yeah, let's talk with the musicians.
Have you actually endured criticism about the gender and race?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, not so much the race. The only problem with the race was when I read the essay on Alan Wilson in the book, Canned Heat, I said, I always hate the expression good white blues guitarist.
Yeah.
I say it's kind of saying, oh, he's a good black opera singer. It's the most offensive thing you could possibly hear.
You mentioned
hear.
That in your
I do. And then a person, yeah. the Star Review in the weekend said, I flinched when he said that. It's right. Somehow, it's like, you know, it's bullshit. I mean, it's like my idea of prejudice is when you prejudge someone, you look at their skin and say, well, he couldn't possibly be a good poet. Look at the color of his skin. He wouldn't say that. But you say, oh, he's a good white blues guitarist. And it's just ridiculous. Either good or you're bad. You know?
Right.
And there's socioeconomic reasons why there aren't a lot of good white blues guitarists.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, but it's also subjective. Early 20th century, you know, if you saw an Irish guy, well, he's a good fighter. Well, you wouldn't say that now. It would be he's an African-American, right?
Sure.
It's just, you judge the stuff on the basis, and we're so afraid, especially in this country, of saying, I think this music is good. Oh, it's all subjective. It's all contextual. It's all, yeah, it is. But you know what? There's good shit and there's bad shit. And
right.
And Alan Wilson was an amazing guitar player. And Canned Heat is this boogie rock band that has this reputation for being dunderheads, and they were to a great degree, but he was a genius. People don't know about him and they should.
I didn't know much about Alan Wilson. Like I kind of
buried, you know,
he's buried. Yeah.
Cause he's got that classic rock tag of Canned Heat, you know, boogie rock. Cause after he died, they continued for like 12
years.
Yeah.
And then going up the country, like, I mean, there's this kind of that's the song, right?
Yeah,
and it sort of seems silly. The voice is, he's singing in that high register.
And that's his. I just want to, cause I know we're talking about the music. I just want to go back to the thing, and it's okay when people criticize the book. I just don't think you should criticize the book that I didn't write. You know, that's not the book that I set out to write, to be an encyclopedic representation. You know, this is a very subjective novelist's account of some passions that hopefully transcend the particular artist.
You're treading into the territory that we have been inundated with of late in terms of the concept of political correctness.
Right. Yeah.
And I get the impression that you're feeling that this is not a book that judgment should be applied
to. Well, of course you can judge it. I mean, if you can pick it up and say, well, you know, there are only three black people and I don't want to read the book, that's fine, you know, that's cool. But I also didn't sense that, well, I've got to include certain people. I mean, I found Little Richard's story fascinating. I find Sister Rosetta Tharpe's story fascinating. Hound Dog Taylor, another African-American. I mean, he, to me, is one of the great discoveries of my life in the last 10 years. Because you get older, you discover less. I mean, I don't know how old you are, but I'm older than you, I'm sure. And you just fall in love less as you get older.
The time is more precious, for
I guess,
one thing.
I guess.
And I mean, we are, our brains are built to have formative periods.
I guess. Is that true? I never thought of that.
I do think that's true. I mean, the things
I just
that
thought
I'm,
I was getting old and lazy.
No, I mean, when I look at, if I stop and look at this show that I make and the things that I've put the most energy and passion into, there's stuff that you could say had its heyday in the 90s. And
right.
So when did I have
mine's the 70s. So
right. So when did I have my most formative musical experience?
Right,
oh,
right,
the 90s.
Right.
Oh, interesting. And who am I talking about? Like who are the people that I'm really stoked to talk to? Oh, people that made records at that time period. So I don't think of myself as being overtly nostalgic.
Yeah.
It's not, the people I'm talking to are either very active now, still, and for whatever reason, you know, because their initial blast, which is also sometimes misconstrued as their initial and only power.
Right.
That I find it, like going back to the Jerry thing in the dead, I find our dismissal or you know, sometimes people make a bad record, but I generally, if I'm invested in an artist,
yep,
and it could be someone I even loathe now, you know, like something from my youth where I'm like, I don't care about the new U2 record.
Right, right.
I shouldn't care about the new U2 record.
For more than one reason.
But if I will, and this is, you know, I'm not ashamed of it. I don't have that much shame, but your tastes develop. You get a little more discerning, and the things that, I mean, even when I was a kid, that was not a popular band. U2 was right. always kind of this foreign
yeah.
band that the America would try to get behind, but they didn't have resonance. Yeah. Even now, they were never like a big singles band.
No.
At one point, they seemed to be everywhere, but they weren't ever really. But I will, out of loyalty to something, probably still check out a new record.
Yeah.
And even though I find them so loathsome on some level now, yeah. you know, they're not the biggest villains in the world, but they're not very cool. And yeah. they probably never were cool.
Yeah.
however, like, that's a formative part of my being.
Yeah, I think you've hit on it. And, you know, I quote Orwell in the introduction where he says, wide sympathies have their penalties. You know, if you try to be cool, if I tried to be, oh, I'm going to write about an important electronica artist. Well, I don't know that music, yeah. you know? And that I would look foolish. I mean, I'd probably get some pats on the head and say, Robertson did a wonderful job of being inclusive with different shows. No, seriously.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he's really tried to, yeah, and you know what? That kind of book's not going to last. I'm hoping this book, you know, will last many, many years because my passion and, you know, hopefully my writing will allow it to live. But, you know, my subject matter couldn't be less cool in some ways.
There's some amazing turns of phrase in here that I think are just incidental. Like, I'm just like, there's a thing. Forget what it is. Something like you can't make a spoon into a fork, yeah. and if you lie down with dogs, you're yeah. gonna get fleas. Like they're just like little turns of phrase that I quite liked.
Well, yeah, I mean,
in the middle of like this basic, like I'm like, there's a biography, and he's just talking about the records, and then all of a sudden you
right. Yeah, because I didn't want it to be a Wikipedia article, right? I wanted sure. it to be a story, and I only realized this when my voice is gone, because I've been on the road.
Don't worry about it. You're doing well.
Okay, I was, you know, some stuff you don't know until you start talking about it. So I was doing some, you know, talking at these gigs we've been doing this week, and I was like, I kept saying story instead of essay. And I thought, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what these are. They're not going to be interesting to someone. So, oh, this record came out in 1972, and it was a good record. It wasn't like a Rolling Stone record review, you know?
Yeah.
It's a story. And hopefully, anyway, so the point was that, yeah, it's not representative. It's not this or that. But I'm hoping the art itself will allow it to be universal. You know?
Yeah. So I think for the sake of people who have not yet read the book, yeah. and as a way of previewing it, I'm trying to figure out if we can do very succinct.
I'll try to go quick. Yeah,
like a couple minutes on on everyone in the book.
Greatest hits.
Yeah, greatest just hits. Like a little sense of who yeah. they are. So let's start in order. We'll go in okay. order of the book. So Jean Clark,
as happens with most artists that are writers or books or whatever, someone says to you, hey, you got to read her book or something. She's just, so I was a guy, I was living in Texas, and I was into Grammy. He said, have you ever heard of Jean Clark? I said, yeah, isn't that guy from the Birds, you know, only a couple albums, you know, Jangle Rock. He said, oh no, yeah, this really. And so he, you know, back in the day, he made me a cassette tape, you know, and yeah. I was like, and then I just fell in love with this guy's music, very dark, melancholy, minor key, country rock, but more singer-songwriter. And then, of course, the more I got to know about him, his career, he's a really interesting period in the sense that he was that period where the major labels are starting to only be concerned with making, selling big records, and he was still trying to be in that industry, and how his art became less and less interesting as he tried to accommodate that. Now, near the end of his life, he sort of found his niche on a smaller label. But he would have been like who John Prine is today in yeah. terms of like hounding his own little. But he missed that. And he had some terrible, terrible addiction problems. And
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
But I feel that albums like White Light, No Other, and the Dylan Clark albums are, you know, I mean, they leave Neil Young in the dust. They leave. Now, they're right there. I mean, I think he's the true forefather of country rock.
Yeah.
Not Graham. And I love Graham, of course. And woefully underappreciated. And I wanted to begin with the book with him because I thought he was a quintessential artist for this book in the sense that great art, fascinating, sometimes tragic life. But the music survives.
Yeah. You know? Okay. That's the, very good.
Okay.
That's good. That was good. You did a good
job.
That's
true about everybody in the book. We can all do that.
You do have a tendency to look at a band that people might know and then focus on a member of the band.
So you're going to Ronnie now.
We're going to Ronnie Lane.
Right. Well, he's with the Faces, the Small Faces. What I loved about Ronnie, again, finding the music incidentally, you know, and you know, here. Oh, okay, this guy's stuff. Because it's just kind of like a British country rock, gypsy music. He's really interested in, I don't know if that's a politically correct term, but sort of. Gypsies exist anymore, but it's this beautiful. If you listen to Faces stuff, you'll know his stuff I'm talking about, like Richmond and Debris and things like that. Well, he did that and went further. But what the fascinating thing about Ronnie's life is, and again, if you don't care about the music as much as it, he left the Faces at the height of their fame. Yeah. When they are playing hockey rinks in North America where you make the real money, Rod Stewart, the lead singer. And he leaves. He meets this woman, and she sort of helps him come to realize that, you know, this is no way to live. Wait, live in hotels and airports. So he leaves. He takes his money from the Faces. He buys a farm, a Shropshire farm, and a mobile recording studio because he knew the music he wanted to make probably wasn't going to make any money. He called his band Slim Chance.
Right. You know? Right.
So he said, well, I got this kind of, we were talking about with the majors. He's like, well, I know I'm not going to. So I'll rent out my mobile to the Stones and everybody. He made his money that way. And then he thought, geez, you know, I'd love to take this music to the people, places that wouldn't pass the tour analysis. You know, so you know, he'd make this passing show, he called. He'd bring the music to people. They'd have jugglers and he'd play his music. And sometimes it was for 30 people, sometimes for 40 people.
Right.
And of course, it's not all romantic. I mean, he got frustrated. He got frustrated, people not buying his records. Records weren't released in America, which is why they're so hard to get now. For many, many years, they're very difficult to get on CD even. And then, of course, the tragedy with Ronnie is he got MS. And, you know, the tragic line that he says at some point, he turns to friend is, you know, I can't even drink myself to death because this disease is so debilitating.
Right.
And the way that he fought on and made music afterward, even when he eventually moved to America for health reasons, he lived in Austin, he performed in a wheelchair.
You know? Did you get a chance to see him?
I never did. He died, you know what? He died in 97, the year we came back, and for a couple of years previous, he had lived in Colorado for his health, for the air. But, you know, and to be honest, I didn't really know his music then.
Yeah, right.
You know, I didn't know, well, we'll come to the Towns this year. A friend invited me to go see Towns. I said, I'm not going to see some folk singer.
Right.
You know, what an idiot. Yeah. So, we'll come to that one.
Yeah. Okay, I appreciate that. And that's a really compelling story and an heroic one on some level.
Heroic's a good word, yeah.
Yeah. Ramones.
The Ramones was a great one for me because I wasn't into the Ramones when, you know, at the age you probably were. You were hip. I was, you know, I grew up in a small town pre-internet with no older brothers or sisters. This stuff was hard come by. But the Ramones, of course, I knew about. I moved to Toronto, blah, blah, blah. Everyone I talked to, all my friends, oh, yeah, I saw the Ramones. I didn't. I always felt that I was full of so much energy and anger and frustration. I didn't want to listen to music that sort of captured that. So when I got older, I kind of felt like, oh, this is kind of filling a hole in my life.
Yeah, you mentioned
it's like a
that.
Good cup of coffee, you know? And then, of course, the songwriting genius and everything. And then the story was so fascinating with these guys. We were talking about earlier, like they really on their own, they needed every one of them in their weird, freaky abilities to make this entity. I mean, like Dee Dee did want to be the Bay City Rollers. It wasn't being ironic.
Yeah.
You know, A-O, let's go is S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y.
That's a good point.
Like, can you imagine that now? I mean, he talks about, it's not in my book, but I remember an interview I read with him. He's talking about when they're on the road once and the Runaways were opening for him. And they, you know, everybody wants to hang out with Dee Dee because he's the king of partying. He's the cool guy. And they went to his room and he's in his room. He's having a joint. He's listening to Jackson Browne.
Yeah.
And they're like, man, this is, you know, I don't think it's cool. It's like, what are you doing? He's like, this guy's a great songwriter, you
and
know?
Dee Dee
like,
cared about good songwriter.
Songwriter.
Good songwriter. And I mean, this dysfunctional group of people are so bizarre.
They are. You wouldn't even
nothing
need to...
that there's aspect, certainly of Johnny Ramone and his conservatism that don't make any sense in the spirit of what they were after.
Conservatism is euphemism. He's a nut. He's a right-wing nut.
Right-wing nut. Nazi.
Charles Manson.
Propaganda
loving.
Collector. Yeah.
Racist and the whole deal. And then you got everybody else. But the music to me, especially those first four albums to me, is as good as... I mean, my definition of classic rock and roll is not, you know, Emerson. Like, classic rock and roll is the Ramones in the sense that
yeah,
they...
Yeah.
It's rock and roll.
First four or five records are...
It's about
I mean, End of the Century is not so great, but everything else is great.
A little bit of End of the Century, you're right. That's where I stopped my discussion. Yeah. There's another reason why my book isn't scholar. It's like, basically after that, I don't talk about the records after that. I talk about End of the Century because there's some good stuff on it. Phil Spector,
the story's
great.
Story is great.
Then I just say, blah, 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 you know. And someone say, well, where's the discussion of Pleasant Dreams? There's a good song on side two. Well, that's not, these essays aren't that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the Ramones thing to me was these fascinating individuals, this weird music. And that music to me is, you know, Blitzkrieg Bach will be listened to as long as there are people listening to music. It just transcends.
Or playing hockey games or football games or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, Joey would love that.
I have a slight bone of contention about the Ramones chapter.
Right.
And I have the arc.
Okay.
I believe this is the facts that you've stated here. Danny says,
yep.
You mention in your book that you think this is a song about Joey's girlfriend who then ended up
with Johnny.
Ended up with Johnny, which is a great. That's a weird story in the band as well, and it basically destroyed their friendship forever. I think Danny Says is about their manager, Danny Fields.
Oh, it's Danny Sugarman, Danny Sugarman, yeah. Danny Says We Have to Be Here.
Danny
at such
Fields,
a time.
Isn't it?
Danny Fields, I'm sorry, Danny Fields, yes, of course, former, discovered them in the MC5. Oh, yeah, no, for sure. If I didn't put that in there, I meant to, yeah.
Well, you say that it's because his girlfriend's name, I believe, is Danielle.
Oh, I didn't mean to say it. Imply that. Okay. Well, no.
So
that,
I was like, as a fan, I'm that's interesting.
So Danny is a short. No.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, don't apologize.
Danny
I'm fact-checking for you now.
It was like Danny Says We Have a Soundtrack at 2 p.m.,
yes.
But I wish I was with you, Danielle.
Yes,
okay,
that's
well,
right. There
well, that's
go.
What second editions are for, clearing that up. Thank you for pointing that out on the air, by the way, Vish.
I just had a, it's just a minor thing.
That's the problem with this book. You know, you read a novel, and someone says, well, I like it. With this book, I mean, it's only been out for a week, and I'm waiting for you, but people were saying to me, yeah, I read your essay, and they're all freaks of certain bands. It's like, I noticed on page 32, you said that song is 3 minutes and 58.
I hope that didn't seem
I think it's just great, that certain people
There's a documentary about Danny Fields called Danny Says.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, so that's why. And Danny Sugarman, of course, was at Elektra Records.
Of course.
Now I'm correcting you on that, but I didn't mean to do that. I'm just, Danny Fields is an interesting character.
He's a fascinating guy. Yeah, I mean, goes back. He's got great stories about what an idiot Jim Morrison was.
Right, exactly.
He's the one who hooked up Nico and Jim Morrison.
Oh, is that right?
Can you imagine playing Matchmaker? Anyway,
Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Yeah, to me, she is one of the. If I was going to have an agenda for this book, it's like, well, people who are not well known enough. Without her, there wouldn't be rock and roll. I mean, there would have been rock and roll, but there wouldn't have been rock and roll at the time. Jerry Lee Lewis auditioning for Sun, Little Richard auditioning for Specialty. This is before there was such a thing as rock and roll, but they helped invent it. They auditioned with Sister Rosetta Tharpe songs. Now, these weren't deep thinkers. Jerry Lee Lewis admits, I never was much of an intelligent man kind of deal.
Sure, right.
But he said, okay, we'll play some songs. He played Sister Rosetta Tharpe songs. He didn't think, oh, this is a clever way to create a new genre. There was something in her music that was pushing us toward this new art form that she didn't call rock and roll or anything.
Yeah,
but
sure,
these guys did. And again, the brand name.
Yeah.
This new thing, rock and roll. Well, when they auditioned, and Elvis too. Now, he didn't audition with that, but he was a huge. They were all huge fans of hers. Well, why? Well, they all come from the church. They all went to church. They all did the gospel music. They all had the singing. But then there's this little boogie-woogie beat, this little thing, bluesy thing sped up. I mean, it's gospel music sped up, really, in many ways, rock and roll. Then you bring in the hillbilly thing.
Mm-hmm,
but to me, she's at the foundation. And so that's interesting right in itself. But then you've got the story, as we touched on, of her being facing this opposition from her own community, Christians and her own church. And granted, it's a pretty conservative church, but and her going in and playing the clubs. And then there's the question, too. Then she tries to go toward a broader audience. And so her music becomes diluted and less interesting.
Yeah.
And so it's ironic that here she is trying to make it a broader audience, but it's less appealing to people because it lacks that grit and that soulfulness. So that's interesting, too. And then, of course, that she had her own troubles. She may or may not have been bisexual and had a relationship. And she certainly had, like,
abusive relationships.
The
with
worst
men. Yeah.
Tasted men, or whatever you want to call it, you know, predatory men, usually from within the church.
I don't want to armchair psychoanalyze this, but she had a weird relationship with her father, too, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
And her mother.
That's right. She had a weird...
Her mother never told her that she did well. I mean, she took a part of the riches and stuff, but there was always that ambivalence, like, you know, like we've got a nice house, but I don't like where you're getting the money to make this from.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of deal, right. Yeah.
And then she suffers these physical disabilities, and you know, she's up there. She got her leg amputated, and so she's up there on crutches. And also the thing is, she's a wicked lead electric guitar player, which is bizarre for that time. Not only gospel, but a woman up there cranking it away. You know,
right?
You can talk about girl power. You know,
it's a remarkable chapter. A story I didn't know at all. Yeah,
she's great.
Towns Van Zandt.
Well, Towns, as we talked about at the beginning of the essay, I lived in Texas, and a friend said to me, "Hey, man, I know you're in a list, like, talking about Graham Parsons and all this. You should go see Towns." And he said, "Folk singer." And I'm not going to go see that.
You weren't into folk music at the time.
Well, I thought folk is, you know, like, you know, Pete Seeger or that kind of stuff. Or at best, it would be like Cat Stevens or, you know, Harry Chapin or singer-songwriter.
Things
stuff.
That didn't have an edge necessarily.
Yeah, edge. You know,
I mean, Seeger did, but
pretty,
I mean...
Yeah, well, I respect Pete Seeger, the way, but I don't want to listen to, you know, protest songs or anything, right? And so what happened was, ironically, so Towns died January 1st, 1997. We were still living in Texas. We didn't go back until May 97, my first book came out. And so... Everybody had Towns in the air. Towns was like Jesus down there.
Absolutely.
So it was like, he was in the cover of this and this. And so my wife came home with a twofer CD she had. I guess she's more adventurous. She listens to new music. There's this great radio station down there, and they would play, you know, they'd play, you know, Willie Nelson, then they'd play Tom Petty, then they'd play Nirvana, then they'd play Webb Pierce. And I guess she heard some Towns or something. Anyway, she came home with this CD, which was a twofer that had late great Towns Van Zandt and High Low and In Between. And I took it. I was like, wow, where have I been missing this? And then we moved back to Canada, and I started slowly assembling the stuff. And he just, to me, is that wonderful, the best of what American music can do, that weird America. It's like country, it's folk. It's certainly, there's a blues element to it, but it's also very literate. It's a guy who obviously had read Robert Frost and had read Dylan Thomas. And it's like, it's this wonderful, Towns is one of those artists that, we used to talk about this when I was younger with writer friends. It's like, you don't want to be the guy who go into a secondhand bookstore and they have a whole section of your books.
Yeah.
You know, somebody wins an award or somebody talks about a book and everybody goes and buys it and everyone gets rid of it. You don't go into too many secondhand record stores and find Towns records.
Right.
People either don't care, don't like it, which is fair too. You know, people aren't going to like my work, or don't know about it. Or if they like it, this is mine, get your own. I will turn you on to this. I'm going to lend you this, but you got to give it back kind of thing, right?
It's like you don't see that many used Toyotas. People like their Toyotas.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a reason, right?
Yeah.
The actions speak louder than words.
Yeah.
So Towns is one of those guys, and I always sort of, I can always, it's a, you used to talk about handshake books, you know. People would say, you know, do you like Richard Yates? Do you know who Richard Yates is, a writer? Yes, you do. Okay, you're one of us, kind of deal. Towns is one of those ones you either turn somebody on. Do you like it? Do you know about it? Okay, if you don't, it's like you don't want to hang out people who don't drink. You know, you don't hang out people who don't like Towns. I don't really want you to hang out at my house.
Right.
Okay. He's one of those guys.
Okay,
know?
Cool. And I mean, his story.
And then the addiction part of it is just very, very, very. Good lesson, good essay to read, good story to hear about, whether from me or someone else, about how you can't romanticize. I mean, you know, red wine's an important part of my life, but at the same time, there's a great Churchill lines where they asked what his alcoholism. He said, you know, alcohol, I've taken more from alcohol than alcohol's taken from me.
Right.
And there comes a point where it takes Towns' soul away, et cetera. And I'm not, I didn't write any cautionary tale, but you can't read that essay and think that I'm romanticizing substance
There's a
abuse.
Couple of such essays where obviously people are, I don't know what it is about the artistic impulse to also push your own being as far as it can go when you're supposedly pushing the envelope, so to speak, or whatever, or trying to assert, I don't know. It's a weird aspect.
And, you know, you
it.
Have, you know, dentists and factory workers who have alcoholism problems.
Absolutely,
But you're right. There is this. But there does come a point when the booze starts thinking for you or the drug starts, and you're not, it's not furthering anything. You're not going, you're not even having more fun.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you're not even having fun. You're trying not to feel physically bad.
Right.
You know,
right.
Which is not cool. Yeah.
Little Richard.
Little Richard was, my parents have been the most supportive, wonderful people in the world, but neither of my parents went to high school. There were no books around our house or anything like that. But subsequently, you know, they were always supportive of me, but as typically as, you know, working class people are of their kids to go get an education. All that. They weren't too thrilled when I did philosophy. Then when I told them, I made a career decision, I'm going to be a novelist, they weren't too thrilled.
Yeah, right.
But what we did have around our house was lots of 50s records and stuff. My dad was 8 tracks, if you know, you remember those. And
yep.
And I would just sit and listen to the 8 tracks. And they'd be like, you know, he didn't have great taste. We didn't have like, you know, cool renditions. They'd be these like, you know, mixed, you know, best of the 50s CD, 8 tracks. And the stuff would come on. It was all nice and catchy. Then Little Richard would come on and it would kind of scare me, you know. The lyrics were so incomprehensible.
Right.
You know, wah, bah, baloo, bah, blah, bam, boom, tutti, free, bone, Rudy, you know. It's like, it was like nursery rhymes almost. And the music was furious.
Yeah.
And I talk about in the essay how, you know, everybody's Little Richard. They've seen him on 90120 or whatever. He's you know, he's a nice old man. You put the headphones on, you put that stuff up, it's crazy music. It's well, just crazy.
He was willing to be a bit of a cartoon, or certainly now.
Sure.
He's happy to, he seems happy to.
Oh, sure. He's nice and, yeah, at the time it was dangerous music. But yeah, what was interesting about him was, and I talk about, and again,
it's a very salacious, it's the most, probably the most salacious essay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, in terms of his personal life, too. Yeah. And also, you know, Tutti Frutti was originally called Tutti Frutti Good Booty.
Right.
It was about anal intercourse.
Right.
Right. And he would perform it at frat parties. He would get dressed up very, very kind of like femme. And he played these frat parties for white rich white kids, and they loved it. And he would sing these ribald songs. And actually, there's a good example going back to Sister Rosetta Tharpe. So he does his audition.
Oh, that's right.
Specialty.
That's a great
story. And
they're
like, yeah, these are great, but you know, a million people can write these songs,
yeah,
or sing these songs. Like, I need something different. So they go to have lunch, and they have a couple of drinks. They have some lunch, and he's a show off, as all artists are. And so he goes over to the piano, and he starts, you know, playing that song. And they said, "That's something. Wow, what is that?" Well, we can't have those lyrics. They brought this woman in, who was their lyric writer, and she turned it into Tutti Frutti.
Right.
And instead of Good Booty, it's a song that makes no sense. But
I mean, it still seems to be about what it's supposed to be about.
Well, that's what all great art is, right? You,
yeah,
don't spell it out. Yeah. So,
I thought where you're going is that Sister Rosetta Tharpe actually let Little Richard sing.
Well, that's
on
all
stage
these little
as a
connections.
Kid.
Yeah, that was, yeah, a big moment in his life. He worked at the wherever the Macon Civic Center or whatever.
Yeah.
And she heard him singing out front. No band, just singing.
He just was singing,
yeah,
to impress her, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she said, and he went up there, and I think he said he got like $75, which would be like, you know, his father's wages for 2 weeks or something. He's like, this is the life.
Yeah, right, right. Idea. She gave him some
And
dough.
There are these connections. It's like nearly all of these people, too. They all, a lot of them saw Elvis Presley, yeah, on the Ed Sullivan Show, or the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan,
yeah,
or saw the Hard Day's Night, the movie.
Right.
I mean, different artists or whatever, it changed their lives that way. Or these other people, they were all in the church music.
It, yeah,
was,
right,
connections that I didn't plan out. If it seems that way, I'm not that clever.
It, no, just, no, seems, it just,
they all have these connections. So,
yeah, yeah, no, and I'm sure you discovered
that. So Little Richard, and plus Little Richard struggled with his homosexuality, and it truly was. I mean, this guy never said, you know, even when he was playing rock and roll and indulging in homosexual sex, he still thought that he was wrong, that it was dirty, that he was being sinful.
He sinful. Had an inner conflict, yeah.
Yeah, and then, yeah, he would stop playing for 10 years. He would marry a woman, poor woman.
Yeah.
And you know, Little Richard, I'm going to cure myself of my, and so it's this, but what comes out of it is the tension is his music, right? You,
yeah,
need the irritation to make the pearl. So maybe if he doesn't have this goes back to your, what is it about art? Maybe if he doesn't have this inner pain, he doesn't play,
yeah,
those shows,
you don't know. No. Yeah, you just don't know. It's, yeah, I think at some, yeah, point you also make a funny joke about which came first, the chicken or what was the other
chicken or the alcoholic,
that chicken, know? Or the alcoholic. Yeah. Well, not quite what I was thinking there, but yeah,
still it's that tension, like, you know, what causes what, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's,
yeah,
a great performer. He's a great performer too, because I think he feels on stage he can be himself and be alive.
Absolutely. Yeah,
you know, and if you don't, if you feel comfortable in your skin, well, maybe you don't get up on stage. Make a fool of yourself.
And yeah. I mean, as it stands in our trajectory, interestingly, I think Little Richard's the only one who's still alive at this point. We're going to keep going, and we're going to keep going here. But
more,
yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Alan Wilson.
Alan Wilson, we talked about earlier.
From Canned Heat.
You say Canned Heat. You can go on YouTube and see Cam Heat. He's this little myopic, pasty, pudgy, white guy from the suburbs of Massachusetts.
Possibly who, socially inept?
Not possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly, if he wasn't a virgin, he probably had sex a couple times unsuccessfully.
Wait, what does that have to do with being socially inept?
Well, he wasn't comfortable socially. He wasn't comfortable
also,
with women.
He didn't bathe.
He didn't bathe.
By the way, I want to be clear. I don't want to ruin this book for people. We're like spilling a lot of beans here, and there's just stories here that I want to get to. Yeah, yeah. I hope you're okay with this. I'm doing.
No,
there's
I'm
been
great,
no spoiler alert
this
here.
This is going to be the best conversation I'm going to have, of course, this book, because it's a like-minded individual who's read the book. But so he's this guy in this band, and they kind of get popular for a little bit. And
blues aficionado.
Blues aficionado. Yeah. I mean, these are the guys that, such aficionados that they would go and collect 78s. And if they found a 78 of one they had, they would break it so theirs would be more rare. You know, they were these guys. They were just that freaks. And so they become a blues rock band, and they have their kind of moment in the sun. They play at Woodstock and stuff. But Alan writes the stuff on album after album that becomes less and less traditional blues. He uses the blues, but it becomes really like Poor Moon, which is a song I talk a lot about in there. It's a song about how we're polluting the moon. You know, the space shuttle's going up and we're already junking up. This is in 69.
Yeah.
It's like ecology, as they called it back then, in a blues format.
He seems a little prescient, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, too. Yeah. And I mean, he was on about the California Redwoods, the gatefold of future blues. You open it up and there's a picture of the band standing around Redwoods and Alan looking up information. This is how, you know, right away to this box office and help us save the Redwoods.
And people thought he was like a conspiratorial
nut. Like he's a freak, And this wasn't just some hip thing. I mean, he was very depressed. He talked. This was a guy who was a kid, you know. He'd come running in the house. His mom said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I hear the trees are crying, you know. The wind's blowing the trees." I mean,
epitome of existential angst.
And he talked about the blues, you know. And he dies at 27. There's some speculation he killed himself. I put some arguments for it. Not my own. Other people have done the research in that coroners. But I don't think he killed himself. But I don't think he was concerned with being alive very much. And he tried to kill himself a couple of times. And it's a tragedy because the last album was great. I mean, this guy, too, is the guy who helped Sunhouse recover his career.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is a particularly fascinating essay for me because I think if you only know the popular aspects of Canned Heat,
right.
You're not going to delve into Alan Wilson.
Yeah, and this is the guy that, you know, when they made an album that was released after. The last album that he made with Canned Heat was an album with John Lee Hooker called Hooker and Heat. And he made that album, as I put out in the book. Alan was in the mental hospital. He would check himself out on Friday at 5 and check himself back in at noon on Sunday so he could go on that album. And that album, now it's Hooker's album, as it should be, but the stuff that he and Alan do together on what was side two of the first album is haunting stuff. And Hooker says, you know, he was a genius. Hooker was
very impressed.
Yeah, I mean, they were two peas in a pod, but even he said, "I didn't know the kid."
Yeah.
He couldn't know him. He'd just sit in the corner and kind of look at his shoes, you know. Everybody else is partying and, you know. So anyway, Alan's very close to my heart.
Very compelling chapter, yeah. Willie P. Bennett, speaking of geniuses, Willie P. Bennett.
Willie P. Bennett. Do you know Willie's work?
I do a little bit. I mean, I got to see him and share stages with him when he was with Fred. And,
oh, wow.
And one of my dear friends is Scott Merritt.
Don't know Scott.
Scott would have worked on some of those Fred records. And,
okay. Yeah. Well, Willie P. Bennett is a Canadian singer-songwriter that I talk about. When I came to Toronto from my small town, I wanted to see a folk musician, you know?
Yeah.
I knew about... I just talk about folk, but I mean like Neil Young. I was like, wow. So I looked up in Now magazine. It said, this folk singer at the Free Times Cafe at Spadina College. I went because I knew that intersection. That's the reason I went.
Yep.
And I went and I was blown away by this guy. And at that point, he didn't have a record label. He made a self-financed cassette and he had a little bag over his shoulder and he sold them. And this comes back to that question. So he made three albums in the 70s.
That's like the early version of Bandcamp.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, yeah. And we talk about the fanaticism of these artists. Towns Van Zandt's first record came out in Poppy. That label was created by Kevin Eggers to bring out Towns' music. Willie P. Bennett's records, Woodshed Records. David Essick created Woodshed Records to bring out Willie's record. These people thought, these guys have to be heard. The industry's not paying attention to them. Hound Dog Taylor, we'll talk about later, created by Bruce Egler, Records.
That's right.
So anyway, so Willie P. Bennett was this, I guess you'd call him a folk singer, but it was very country-infused. His records are full of mandolins and stuff. And I would see him around town. He's the only person in the book I knew personally. And I always just, I don't know what I was doing with my life, but he just was his beacon of integrity. And when we talked about living anonymity, I mean, if he got 40 people out and he sold some merchandise, but he still, you know, he built docks, he did drywall, he did all these things.
Yeah.
And you can say, oh, it's terrible, he should have, but also it was very inspirational. And I think that, again, you don't have to be an artist to be inspired by somebody who meets obstacles in their life and perseveres and, you know, lives a good life, you know, as best he could. And
good humor, like a very funny guy.
He was a funny, self-deprecating.
Yeah.
And when I came back to Canada in 97, I wanted to go see Willie play. And there's, oh, Willie's a flying squirrel. What's that? Oh, he's with Fred Eaglesmith. And that's why I got introduced to Fred. I didn't know Fred's music.
Yeah, sure.
So I went out, and that was your classic lineup. Where they had Fred, when Willie was playing this mandolin with a tremolo thing, it just like crazy. And, and Washboard Hank playing himself, you know, kind of deal. And Ralph on bass. And they were a powerful. And Fred was touring a great album, Lipstick Lies and Gasoline. And I saw them so much. And Willie was... But I was like, well, why isn't Willie playing his gigs? And that's one of the things the essay's about. He got tired of it, and he kind of like removed himself from the scene and became a side man.
Yeah.
And I always thought, well, geez, what about Willie's? What about Willie? And so that's one of the things that essay's about. You know, how do you survive? You got to pay bills. How do you do it?
And I mean, it's not a, what, you know, you mentioned some of the labor work he would have done.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, to even be a sideman in a well-paying gig with Fred Eaglesmith has got to be fulfilling.
Fulfilling. That's one of the things he said. Like he knew, you know, they had gigs. They had nice gigs. You know, Fred, you know who Fred. And
yeah.
They work hard, but, you know, they're well respected. They play nice places.
Yeah, yeah.
They travel on a nice bus. Yeah. I mean, it's hard work. I don't know. I mean,
and he always shone a light on Willie.
Like, he obviously loved Willie and respected him greatly. Yeah. And to me, to this day, and I still think Fred's a great artist, is that I always just look on stage and I always look, that's where Willie stood. Yeah. You know, because he brought, and the harmonica work he brought to Fred's work, and yeah, so anyway,
that's there's some hard chapters. I mean, when you look at it, there's not that many. Interestingly, there's not that many. I mean, Willie's the only Canadian, right?
He's the only Canadian, which, you know, will probably get me in trouble with someone else too.
Fine. I just pointed that out.
Next time I write with a tragically hip, I'll do that. Okay.
Graham Parsons.
Well, Graham Parsons, I wasn't going to write about because I wrote a novel called Moody Food, and I thought I had said everything I just said. That's not. It's not about Graham. It's about a guy named Thomas Graham. And
it's based on him, right?
Based on him, but I said it in Yorkville in the 60s, so it becomes somebody else and blah, blah, blah. But I thought that I had captured everything I wanted to say about Graham, so I wasn't going to write about Graham. And, of course, the longest essay in the book is about Graham because it turns out I had more to say. But he's a good example, too, of how things change over time. You're telling me relationship with you, too, in the sense that my appreciation of his art has not diminished. It's only increased. But writing that essay, I did realize I probably wouldn't want to hang out with Graham. He was a very charismatic guy, but at the same time, he wasn't a good friend.
He was a prick.
He was a prick.
Based on this.
Machiavellian. Like, what can you do for me in my career? And if you can't, bye.
Yeah.
The way he joined and quit bands and dropped people. But at the same time, people kept coming back.
Entitled rich kid on some level.
A lot of levels.
Yeah.
But that benefit is art too, you know, like, because he got a twice yearly, what do you call it? And
when you, he got a
not stipend.
It was a $50,000
trust fund. And, yeah. So
biannual though.
Biannual.
So actually $100,000 a year he got for
and
nothing.
That's a 1970, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So he's able to do things like, okay, the Flying Burrito Brothers. We're right there. You're probably even in an era of crazy names. Their two greatest songs, their sweetest, most beautiful ballad, Hot Burrito Number One.
Right.
I mean, he can take these chances. Their music was this amalgam of R&B and country, and Sneaky Pete does this crazy stuff on Steel. That gives him that safety net that probably made him an entitled, you know, SOB to live with. But at the same time,
but the flip side of that is
adventuresomeness.
Right. The flip side is that he wasn't actually motivated by money.
Exactly. He already had it.
Yeah. Exactly.
He already had it. Yeah. Exactly.
So if you actually separate that, you can kind of see his rebelliousness almost as quintessential rock and roll.
Exactly, exactly. And see, this is one of the things that I call these stories as opposed to essays. I mean, an essay sounds like you have an agenda and you want to prove things. One of the reasons that I left philosophy and went to literature was that you can include all of that ambivalence, all those contradictions, all that gray matter that makes life interesting. So fiction, a novel can do that. So Graham's not good or bad or a nice guy or a bad guy. I mean, he was all those things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which I think a good book or a movie has to do. It has to be, you know, the bad guy's still a good guy to his mother, you know.
Right,
you put that in
right,
there,
exactly.
Know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hound Dog Taylor.
Hound Dog Taylor was a relatively recent enthusiasm. He was he played almost exclusively slide, wicked slide on a Sears Roebuck guitar with a rhythm guitar player and a drummer. And he was always drunk, and he always plays taverns until he got kind of hipped up by Bruce Egler, and they started this label, and the college crowd kind of took him in. And I've never heard anything raw or more visceral or more. Yet he had a good ear, and his music is a party. His music, you put that music on, people start moving around. Like I say in the book, his music is best heard in a kitchen full of drunken people.
Yeah.
And he said that always. He said, you know, my music is about a party, but it's also very sad music, but not sad in a gentle, melancholic way, in the sense like life is rough. Mm. It's rough. And the blues is such a, it's so easy to fall into cliches with the blues, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've always had, I grew up in Detroit, so I grew up listening to, well, not listening to, but hearing a lot of Chicago blues. It got really tired to me. And hearing this stuff, it just sounds, it just explodes out of your speakers, especially his live album, Beware of the Dog.
I mean, the way you describe it, it sounds like punk rock or garage rock
yeah.
or something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's nothing rawer than this, unless yeah. you're trying to use like sound, you know, doing a Sonic Youth thing with noise.
Sure.
But there is noise. I mean, this squall of his slide guitar is just, it's filthy. It's just absolutely filthy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in a good way.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, he's great. And also his struggle, I mean, he was a full-blown, I mean, he drank in the morning. I mean, when I talked to Bruce Egler,
two shots of coffee,
or he yeah. would be shaking kind of yeah. deal. And obviously, not a good thing for him as a person. But he lived to be on stage and have people, his big, before every show, he'd say, yes, we're going to have a good time now. It's like,
that's right.
He lived to be a party, you know? Ironically, what killed him wasn't booze, but cigarettes. He had lung cancer, so.
Yeah.
Lesson to you out
but
there.
But you mentioned that he couldn't have a cigarette without a drink.
So might as well have been
yeah,
booze,
might as
right,
well exactly. have been booze, right. Now, this is interesting. The next chapter, the next essay in the book combines two gentlemen right. who I don't think their careers, there's no dovetailing
nope,
of them
nope.
as people. Why did you come? This is.
And my editor asked that. And they are the other two who are alive, by the way.
Otherwise, right, exactly.
Paul Siebel and Willis Allen Ramsey. I included them together because Willis Allen Ramsey made one of the most brilliant albums that I know of, country, rock, folk, whatever. And that's it. He made one album in 1972. And he didn't die young. He's still alive. Paul Siebel made two albums that are, the first one is equally as good and transcendent. The second one is wonderful, but not as great. And then he never made another album. And it wasn't because of drugs or alcohol or they decided to pull a Rambo and move away. They just never wrote any more great songs that they felt comfortable with. And so the essay was, yes, I want people to know about their music and, you know, hey, buddy, you know, check her music out or check his book. But also I wanted to, you don't choose to write novels or music or something. You kind of have to, unless you don't want to become a professional, you know, which is the yeah. worst kind of music, you know. Oh, here comes his new book, you know. It's like, oh, stop writing books, please, you know, we've heard this before. And these guys had a quality control level that was off the charts.
Well, it also speaks to the well and when it
yeah.
runs dry.
Yeah, and the mystery of it, right?
Yeah, and not fighting it. I mean, there are people who fight. They have careers,
yeah,
and they may not have anything left to say, but they keep going.
Right. Yeah,
just habitually, and because that's their job.
And I can understand that. And now Willis Allen Ramsey, he was lucky, or maybe cursed in a way that the Captain and Tennille took one of his songs
yeah,
and made
right.
a hit out of it. So
Muskrat.
He never had to worry about money.
Yeah,
which maybe is a good thing. But then again, the Sistine Chapel was a house painting job,
that's
right?
You mentioned that in the book too.
So he made something kind of special out of it. But if he was like, if he wasn't, you know, forced to it economically. Now, Paul Siebel, he made his money. A few people covered his songs, but they weren't like big people. They were like early Bonnie Raitt and Linda Ronstadt. So he didn't make a lot of bread that way. But he was able to tour because there was still a folk music touring circuit back then. But come the 80s, it slows down. And he becomes a baker. He works for the Parks and Recreation.
Yeah.
He looks back on his life and wonders, you know, did I really do that? And he's very unsure of his musical worth. He's like, I appreciate everybody name dropping me in cool magazines and stuff, but you know, I just made a couple albums that nobody bought. Like, no, these are amazing. So I think those two needed to go together to explore that idea that, you know, living after the thrill is gone, so to speak. How do you keep living? It's got to be a come down, not in terms of money, but just in terms of like, not feeling as alive as you once did, right? I mean,
well, as the book unfolds, it becomes more and more educational as I, you know, I didn't know Hound Dog Taylor's story.
Right.
I didn't know Paul Siebel or Willis Allen Ramsey's story.
Right.
So that's going to make me
track
down some records.
And if you don't know, then that's a good litmus test because you pretty much know, you know
well,
a lot that I don't know.
Well, that's not necessarily
true.
That's true. This is, I think it's helpful. So the final essay is about John Hartford.
And I ended it that way on purpose. I was sure I want to start with Gene, like we said, because he sort of was the quintessential Lives of Poets artist. But I wanted to end with Hartford because Hartford did not destroy himself. Hartford led a good life. Now, he died tragically young of cancer. I say young as I'm approaching 50. He was like 62 or 63
right.
or something.
Yeah.
But he did things right, you know. He made a bunch of money when he was making these sort of country pop albums, I guess you'd call them. But he wrote Gentle on My Mind, which Glen Campbell sold a zillion copies. So when he did, he was, you know, the majors wanted to him to leave anyway, but he left the majors. He signed with a label called Flying Fish, this small label, and said, I'm just going to make my records my way. He bought a house in Nashville on the Cumberland River and made these eccentrically bluegrass albums. The album Aeroplane was a life changer for me because it's bluegrass music fused with the Beatles. You know, it's got this great songwriting.
Yeah.
And the lyrics are about like urban planning and falling in love with first cousins and the death of the hippie culture. How do we move? Like all these kind of, it just was an amalgamation of like all these different strains, beat poetry, the Beatles, hardcore bluegrass. And to me, he was such an individual and such a visionary that way, and the strength of his integrity. And again, I ended it that way because he led a quote unquote good life. I mean, he smoked a lot of pot, but I mean,
you viewed it as a happy ending.
Yeah, and you don't, and the first line of the essay, I don't have the book in front of me, but it's like, you know, you don't have to stick a needle in your eye. You don't have to do that.
That's
and
right.
A couple of the reviews say, "Oh, Robertson romanticizes this." You know, I put that essay last on purpose to say, you know what, the goal is to have a good life. It's a great poem by Irving Layton. I think it's called Advice to a Young Poet or something like that. Maybe I'm confusing with Rilke, but he says, no, the goal is to drive them to drink. You know,
it's right.
Drive them crazy. You know, let's live a good life kind of deal. And right. Hartford, to me, was just a guy who made his music and played on other people's records. And then later, this is interesting too, when his sort of muse dries up, I don't know if you'd agree that it did, but it did, he turned to more traditional music. So he'd make an album of... Here's some fiddle tunes by Ed Harley that people don't know about. So I'll do an album of that. Not my cup of tea in particular.
Sure.
I think you got to be a picker, I think, to really be a scholar of it. And I'm not. But that's what he would do. And I end the essay talking about when he had the cancer and he could barely speak and he certainly couldn't play anymore.
Yeah.
He'd have people over to his house for, you know, they have picking parties. Everybody sits around, has some food and some drinks, and everybody plays. So Geeling Welsh, Dave Rawlings played, and so-and-so played. And he couldn't play, so, you know, bring my new CD, put my new CD on. And he'd play his CD, and they'd talk about it.
Right.
To me, that's, you know, we're all going to, it all ends in tragedy. There's always a messy end to everybody's
no,
life.
No, but I can understand why after...
You keep fighting till the end to have fun and connect with people.
There are so many self-destructive stories that are part of this book.
Right.
And they're mixed with genius, right?
Yeah.
So that's the tragedy,
right?
Of what could have been or what should have been,
right.
Maybe. And you know, you're shining a light on all these people because, I don't know what your ambitions were. Hopefully, I would think in some small way, this impacts these people's legacies.
Yeah,
for the people who pick up this book,
maybe go download or buy somebody.
Go buy some records if possible. And I think that I can see why. Hartford story is like the bomb at the end of
Of course, that implies you have
to. But it's still sad.
it's sad because we all die, right?
Yeah.
I mean, every one of my novels, I mean, they're all different, but I think ultimately it's like, you know, we're going to die. What do we do in the meantime? And how do you live a meaningful life? Because there is no ultimate. I mean, the last essay in 15 Reasons to Live, you know, there's an essay on friendship and on art and intoxication and work. Well, the last essay is called Death because it's there. And how can we use death to live a better life? You know, we talk about its brevity then, appreciate it kind of deal. So the Hartford essay to me was, yes, it's a positive essay, but it's not a syrupy, like, you too could, it's like, you know, you're still going to get cancer and die tragically young. We all are,
sure.
You know,
sure.
If you're lucky, and as opposed to, you know, falling apart in a nursing home. But at the same time, here's a guy that right to the end, because he fought this disease for many years, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, so it wasn't like he died, you know, he had about 8 years or so. And he still played, you watch, most people's contact with John Hartford is either the cover of Gentle My Mind or he was in Down from the Mountain.
Yep, that's right.
He's sort of the MC in that, right?
Yep.
Not his finest moment because he's not a well man, but you see him up there and he's still contributing. He's still participating. He still wants to be part of it.
This was the O Brother, Where Art Thou
right.
concert.
And that was the big spike in bluegrass sales because of that movie. And he's in there. He's not a well man, but he's still there and he's still entering into that thing that is transcends the individual, you know, the music, the tradition, the community.
Yeah.
Like, in a lack of a better word, he's trying to have fun. And
having
fun's not easy. Life's hard. You know, there's work and kids and you look around you and the world's such a bad place and stuff. But all of these musicians, I think, brought a little bit more light into the world. And, you know, I need that in my life. And so I guess these people did it for me. So I was like, you know, here's some. And hopefully as other people will, you know, if your favorite people aren't in the book, you know, God bless them. You know, write your own book or talk about your issues.
No, I like the mix of.
It's very narrow, but at the same time, I hope that.
Someone could make the arguments we discussed earlier right. about the scope of it, but I appreciate that it's from a personal place and that it does reveal a kind of eclectic taste in, within you.
Okay.
I think so. I think it's there. I mean, God, really, the outlier on some level is probably Ramones, but at the same time, they make sense. Well, they make sense with Little Richard. Like, I mean, there's Ancestor Rosetta Tharpe. Everyone's got an edginess to them in here.
Yeah, and that's true. And I think that's the thing. We go way back. I don't know how long we've been talking, but way back about books. And, you know, forget about, you know, everything else. I just like books that have an edge. And it could be the edge of Penelope Fitzgerald's satire, or it could be the edge of, you know, Jack Kerouac. But the point is, they both have this aliveness, this intensity. And I just don't, I didn't study English at university, so I was never taught the fine art of pretending to appreciate boring books, you know. I needed to find a book that paid off, not at the end, but every sentence had to be alive, etc. And all these musicians to me feel very, very alive. And when I put them on, my mood changes either, you know, excited with the Ramones or melancholic with Sister Rosetta or hopeful with, you know, and that's to me the definition of art. You know, it makes you feel more alive.
Yeah, that's great. That's well put. Now, Ray, I appreciate this conversation about this book. And I before we go, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a novel, of course, because now I finished the book of nonfiction. So tentatively, it's fall 2017. And it's called 1979. And it's about a 13-year-old paper boy living in southwestern Ontario in Chatham in 1979. And what was appealing to me about that was the time period, of course, because 79 is like just before Reagan, Thatcher, Mulroney.
Yeah.
This kid is 13, so he's still a kid, but he's going to be an adult. Where I grew up, 1979 was the last year before most of the factories closed. My dad lost his job in 1980. So it was a really interesting period that way. Right. And because my narrator is a paper boy, he also sees the whole community like other people wouldn't. You not know them.
No, but it's true.
But,
yeah.
But he not only sees the rich doctor, but he sees the new immigrant who's opened the Chinese food place and their life, and he sees the poor black kids over here, and he sees the poor white trash over here, and he sees all of them. So in a way, the book is kind of like my Spoon River anthology book in the sense that it's all the community speaking out. Now, he's too young to appreciate that, so I interpose these kind of like zany newspaper articles that aren't really newspaper articles. They're kind of like prose poems about all the people in the town. So it's but definitely going to be a commercial.
It sounds
disaster,
like you're are you close to a draft?
Yeah, I'm close to a draft. Yeah. I don't have any kids and I got no hobbies. So this is what I do. So, and I have dogs. My dog recently died, but we're going to do a bunch of stuff in the States in May for this book. We're going to do a little tour. We're actually in homage to Ronnie. We're calling it the Slim Chance Spring 16 tour because we're not sure anyone's going to show up. So we're calling it Spring Chance. So when we return in May, we're going to get another rescue dog. But in the meantime, yeah, I like to walk my dog and you know, listen to music and drink wine and write books, and you know, and this is not bullshit. It's really nice to actually talk to somebody who actually cares about good books and music and has actually read the book. This has been a ball, man. It's been
thank
a ball.
Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it. It's been fun for me too. Is there an online hub for you?
I'm not really an online guy, but I do have a website because the publisher made me have one for events and stuff like that. And there is a Facebook page, but I'm not on it. It's just for them to think. But rayrobertson.com, and there is a Facebook. If you want to contact me though, don't do it through Facebook because I'm not. Send me an email via the website.
Sure.
But visit the Facebook things. It's got all the articles and stuff. I've got a guy who does that for me and whatever. But
right.
But and also that's got all the tour info and stuff. So you know, if I just started. The book came out last week. And
yeah.
So it's like come out and have a chat and talk some music. You know.
So Lies of the Poets with Guitars by Ray Robertson. RayRobertson.com and also biblioasis.com. That's the publisher. Ray, this was a real pleasure. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Ray Robertson and the people at Biblioasis Books for setting up this conversation. Ray, that was fun. I already told you it was fun. You know it was fun. I hope you had fun, Ray. Still listening back to this, if you did. He's a good man. Check out this book. It's great. You can learn more about it, as I mentioned there, at the Biblioasis website. And it's available in the United States of America, I believe, starting this week. So if you're listening in the States, pick it up. Pick it up. If you want to listen to Creative Control of Vish Khanna, it's available on iTunes, audioboom.com, vishkhanna.com,
You can go to patreon.com and look up the show to make a flexible monthly donation and keep the podcast going. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. Look us up at Vish Creative on Twitter. I'm at Vish Khanna, by the way, if you want to follow me and then delete me a week later because you realize, why am I following this man? Also, the show is available on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time, and worldwide at CFRU.ca. You can listen anywhere in the world, not just in Guelph and the surrounding area. And that's all I have to say, I think, for now. That's it. I'm done. There's more shows coming. I have some stuff that I have planned. Did some live tapings over the past weekend that went well. Waiting on the tape still, but we'll get it soon, and then you can hear that. And that's all I have to say. All right, thanks for listening and supporting the show. Tell more people to listen to it if you can. Tell them to download the episode so that the show seems like a thing people care about, and we'll go from there. I know you care about it. Don't feel bad. You and I care. We care. We just need more people to care. We always do. That's what everyone wants, really, right? Okay, I've gone on too far and too long. My name is Vish. I'll talk to you soon. Goodbye for now.